From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Later on in our show, we're going to turn to one of the biggest international stories. We'll give you an on-the-ground report from Kenya, where hundreds of people have died in post-election violence. But first, let's take a look at the fast-paced but calmer waters of American politics. Call the Iowa caucuses coffee, tea, and listen to me! In some cases, people have to declare their preferences openly to neighbors and friends. Here to tell us what's going on in Iowa is NPR's national politics correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Farai.
So you've covered these caucuses before. How does it feel this time around?
This time around, it just feels much, much more intense. I've covered caucuses where one party wasn't competing because they had a sitting incumbent president, or in 1992, none of the Democrats came here because Senator Tom Harkin, who was a favorite son, was running and everyone else decided not to compete. This time, Iowa is extremely important. Both sides have big, wide-open fields, and they have been here for months and months, spending tremendous amounts of time, money, huge numbers of staff, volunteers, thousands of ads. It's just incredibly intense.
So what did the candidates do the night before the caucuses?
Well, the candidates are campaigning up to the very last minute. They're making their case. They're going door to door. A big push to try to identify their supporters and do everything they can to get them to come out, especially on the Democratic side. That's a big commitment. You have to go to the caucuses and stay for 2 hours. The campaigns are arranging rides, babysitters, everything that someone needs to actually get out of their house and get there.
How many Iowans typically go to these caucuses? Is it widespread, or do most people end up watching the results at home?
Well, it's actually a very small percentage of actual registered voters. In 2004, 124,000 Democrats went to the caucus. That's a very small percentage. About 89,000 Republicans went. And the reason why such a small percentage of voters go is because, as I said, at least on the Democratic side, it's a big commitment of time. You also have to do it in public. You have to stand up in your precinct caucus and say who you're for, and maybe even say why you're for them. So it's a big commitment, and it's a very small universe, and that's why the campaigns have been working so hard, not just to identify people who are likely to caucus and have caucused before, but people who they can convince to go to a caucus for the very first time.
What about first-time voters, non-voters, independents? How does their participation or non-participation play into this?
Well, it's a huge factor this year. And as a matter of fact, it's a very controversial factor because the prediction of how many of those people, independents, non-Democrats, first-time caucus goers, are actually going to show up has figured into the polling. Now, it's very hard to predict a caucus result. It's very hard to design a poll that will actually determine who is a likely caucus voter and who's not. Nobody cares about what Iowa Democrats think. People care about what likely Iowa Democratic caucus goers think. And the Des Moines Register's final poll used a model that included a lot of independents and non-Democrats because they believed that at least Barack Obama was going to be successful in his efforts to get those kind of people to go to the caucuses. And the other campaigns didn't like it at all because they felt that that kind of a model favored Obama. And the poll did show him 7 points ahead of Hillary Clinton and 8 points ahead of John Edwards. If you take other polls that are based on a model that show only Democratic regulars, people who have caucused before, are going to show up tonight, then Hillary does a lot better. So that is one of the big wild cards that everybody's going to be watching tonight. How many new people, how many independents, non-Democrats actually go to caucus? Because you don't have to decide in advance. You can show up at your precinct. You don't even have to be a registered voter. You can register on the spot. You can be a Republican and register as a Democrat for the purposes of the caucus tonight.
All right. There's always Mother Nature getting involved. The weather is another X factor. What is it like? How cold is it? What's on the ground? Is this going to help
cold.
Or hurt?
I think it's fine weather, actually, for caucusing. There's no ice storms or snowstorms. It's cold, but Iowans are certainly used to that. It's cold and clear. And I don't think that there's anything about the weather that is going to stop someone who wants to get out for going tonight. Maybe the Orange Bowl will be a bigger deterrent, but certainly not the weather.
Well, Mara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Mara Liasson, NPR's national politics correspondent, and she joined us from our election studios in Des Moines, Iowa. Now we've got a couple of strategists from opposite sides of the aisle. Democrat Jamal Simmons was press secretary for the presidential campaigns of both Senator Bob Graham and General Wesley Clark. And we've also got Angela McGowan. She's a Republican strategist and founder of the consulting firm Political Strategies and Insights. Welcome, folks.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Chidea.
So let's break it down. The day is here. Angela, how important is Iowa in the big picture?
Iowa is very important, and with some candidates it can make or break them. Huckabee and also John Edwards, if they don't win, some things could be pretty bad for them in the near future. Also, it shows momentum. It's also a litmus test for message and organizing. So I think for certain candidates, it's really big.
We just heard from Mara Liasson talking a bit about the structure of the caucuses, the weather, things like that. Jamal, when you look at this particular caucus, where you do have a host of Republicans and a host of Democrats, not just one party, you have a president who will be leaving office, a two-term president. What's the general mood and what's the energy level?
Well, on the Democratic side, the energy level seems to be very high. Most Democrats are looking for somebody who's going to really offer change and really bring the country to a different place. And right now, what we're hearing from a lot of people is that Republicans and independents are really, many independents and some Republicans, are really looking at the Democrats as maybe their option this year to go and caucus for it. There's a lot of energy on the Democratic side right now.
And you know what? I agree with Jamal dealing with the independents, but not just looking at Democrats. I think, Jamal, you have some independents that are out there looking at Republicans as well.
But it's a much smaller percentage.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jamal.
I'm sorry. It's a much smaller percentage that are headed towards
Let me jump in here for a second, because I'm wondering if either of you is troubled by the idea of walk-up registration and that possibly skewing the vote. I'm going to go with you first, Angela, and then Jamal, give me your read.
Well,
I mean,
you know,
in terms of party affiliation.
It's their process, and I've had a conversation with many Iowans, and they take this very seriously, and some people are making up their minds last minute. I think it's great. I think sometimes when we do party politics, just as 90% of black folks vote the straight Democratic ticket. But you saw in 2004, Bush won because he got 16% of the black vote in Ohio. So I like the fact that people can go up and register. And you might be a Democrat, you might see a Republican that you like, and you can go up and register as a Republican. So I like that process.
Jamal?
I agree with Angela on this. Politics is a game of addition. We shouldn't be in the business of keeping people out of voting for candidates. And in fact, for a Democrat to win, they've got to win a fair number of independents and Republicans in order to carry the day in the fall.
And Jamal is right. It is not going to be Democrats or Republicans, I believe, that's going to make the selection. If you have a Hillary and Giuliani, they're going to go after that independent vote, that swing vote. And I think that it's really important. Sometimes party politics can be partisan politics.
Let me tell you a little bit about what we did yesterday. We had two black Iowan voters on the show, different parties, talking about some of the challenges in African-American communities. I want to play just a little bit for you.
Even though we represent about 2.5% of the entire state population, we represent about 26-27% of those in the prison population in the state of Iowa. And in order to address those kinds of issues, we have to look, obviously, at education, what's going on there, why the breakdown. We believe the increased expulsions and suspensions are closely related to the problems associated with the other criminal justice issues.
That was Abraham Funchess, the director of the Iowa Commission on the Status of African Americans in Iowa, and he talked a little bit about these racial disparities in education, incarceration, income levels. Are African Americans being heard, do you think, Jamal?
Well, you know, in Iowa, that's not really what candidates go to Iowa to campaign on. It's about 2.3% of the population in Iowa is African American. I think there's a concerted effort, at least on the Democratic side of the aisle in the primaries, to get those voters out and get them to vote. But clearly they're campaigning among the 95-97% of the population, which is not African American. I think in the Democratic process, that's why we added in states like South Carolina, which will go on the 26th of February, and in Nevada, which will go on the 19th of February, the week before South Carolina, because we want Hispanics and African Americans to participate in a greater way in helping to choose the president.
Angela, what are you looking for this caucus to decide? And I don't mean in terms of candidates, but in terms of, you know, maybe pointing to certain issues that people care about.
Well, I want to say this. Huckabee on the Republican side is reaching out to Democrats, African Americans, unions. He is not pulling out any stop in making this thing happen. I think what the brother said earlier about what's going on in the black community in Iowa represents a lot of communities in America. In New York City, you have 45% black males that are unemployed. You are having higher incarceration rates, and I think there are certain issues that impact the inner city, the Hispanic community and the black community, more so than your white community. But looking at Iowa, it is the first start of the presidential election, and I think that is very important. But I think, too, what is happening in the black community in Iowa represents a lot of inner city communities.
And on this point, I think Angela is at least headed in the right direction. If you look on the Democratic side of the aisle, the issues that are really important are issues of the war in Iraq, the economy, health care. Those are the things that voters want to hear and talk about a little bit more than on the Republican side, where you see immigration and some of the other abortion and some of the other social issues that are still weighing in higher.
I have to disagree with you on one thing. The reason why blacks voted for Bush in 2004, it wasn't because of health care. It was because of the sanctity of marriage and the abortion issue. And I think the Republicans, they are failing in reaching out to the community. I'm trying to help them more in those diversity districts.
All right. Let me give Jamal one quick word because we got to go. Jamal, any response?
Well, I think you're talking general election versus primary. In the general election, African Americans have proved to be sort of more conservative on some of the social issues, and so there is a play for Republicans to make there. But in general, African Americans get turned off by Republicans for issues like Katrina and police brutality and all those sort of things that occur.
Oh, you got to let me respond.
You know what? We are going to let you guys come back on. It's even better than responding. So just stick with us. We are going to come back to you as we progress with this election. Angela, Jamal, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
We've been speaking with Republican political strategist Angela McGowan and Democratic political strategist Jamal Simmons, who spoke with us from our headquarter offices in Washington. Just ahead, after violence, how are Kenya's leaders looking to pull the nation together? And how do you find the strength to achieve greatness when you've stumbled or other people don't believe in you? Stay tuned for the start of our new series, Great Expectations. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Hundreds of people have been killed in a wave of political violence in Kenya. The turmoil began Sunday after results of a disputed presidential election were announced. Today, President Mwai Kibaki says he was ready to talk with the opposition once the nation had calmed down. For the latest developments, we've got Alicia Rue. She's the East Africa Bureau Chief for Voice of America. She joins me now from Nairobi, Kenya. Alicia, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Can you give us a little bit of an update? How many people have been killed and what led up to the violence?
Well, the exact figures are not known because it's difficult to tally all the casualties that have been coming into different hospitals all around the country. I can say that the worst violence has occurred in the western area of Kenya, the Western Rift Valley area, which is a stronghold of the opposition leader Raila Odinga and his Orange Democratic Party. And it's a very deep-seated anger because they believe that the election has been stolen from their candidate, Raila Odinga. Raila Odinga is a Luo tribe member who comes from the area of Kisumu. Kisumu in western Kenya is a stronghold of the Luo tribe. And they really saw Raila Odinga as the person who could end decades of ethnic Kikuyu dominance, and Kikuyus are the ones are the largest ethnic group here in Kenya. And the violence actually began after the announcement that President Mwai Kibaki, who is an ethnic Kikuyu, had won the election. I think it deeply shocked a lot of Raila Odinga supporters, and they vented out their frustration and violence.
Now, European election observers and the U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, the British Foreign Secretary David Miliband, have called for an inquiry into the accuracy of the results. Is this likely to happen?
Of course, the international pressure that is bearing down on Kenya right now is to make a difference, because Kenya is an international community member. It's a partner with the United States in the war and terror, and it's an economic powerhouse in the region, and they need international support and help. And so to defy international calls for reconciliation and for finding some way to end this violence would be very dangerous for both leaders. And so that they cannot ignore that call. But what compromise they will be willing to accept is still not clear.
Knowing what you do about the structure of Kenyan government, is there any possibility of having a coalition government or some sharing of power, or is that completely off the table?
Well, that's exactly what Mr. Odinga has proposed. He says that there should be an interim power-sharing government until fresh elections can be arranged, and that's his latest proposal. I don't know if Mr. Kibaki will agree to that. Many people believe that it's unlikely that he will agree to that because he has not agreed to share power in the past.
Since you're in Nairobi, what's the mood in the city at this point?
Well, the only word that can describe this city is tense. People are fearing that if the political situation is resolved quickly, there could be a lot more violence, and people I've talked to today from Kibera slums and opposition strongholds, they are very ready to push this issue until they get the results they want, which is Raila Odinga in power. So right now, I think that people are just waiting and seeing and fearing the worst.
Alicia Rue, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alicia Rue is the East Africa Bureau Chief for the Voice of America, and she spoke with us from Nairobi, Kenya.
Kenya, Nzuri, Kenya. Zuri, zuri, uwapendeza watu wote, hata wa wazungu.
Have you ever had a moment when you knew you had talent and drive, but nobody would give you a chance? Did you give up or did you make a way out of no way? Well, today, News and Notes launches a new series called Great Expectations. You'll hear from people who expected and achieved greatness when other people didn't expect them to. Today, we've got two people to help us frame the conversation. One is Judge Lynn Toler of Television's Divorce Court. A former real-life judge, she's helped others and herself get through lots of adversity. So has Ellis Coase of Newsweek magazine. He's working on a new show called Against the Odds for Public Radio International. It's going to start airing this month on public radio stations across America. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So, Ellis, let's start with you. You grew up in the projects in Chicago. You have done so many things, traveled so many places. How did expectations, for better or worse, figure into your life?
Expectations were key. Let me just take a second to express just my horror at what's happening in Kenya right now. I was in Nairobi earlier this year and also last year, and it just so happens that the Kisumu, the area where Dingle comes from, is where Barack Obama's father came from, and it's just a tragic turn of events. But going to your question, in my own case, I was helped by so many people, most particularly by Gwendolyn Brooks, who was the poet laureate of Illinois at the time when I was coming up. And she discovered me in a sense and gave me the confidence to believe that I could be a professional writer.
She's one of my heroes. You know, I still cherish her poetry. How did you even meet her?
I met her, and I'll try to make this story very brief. I was this kind of rebellious high schooler and was rejecting the normal assignments. The teacher and my teacher and I agreed that I would write an essay on why there had been race riots that had torn up my community in Chicago. It was turned into a 150-page manuscript before I got finished with it. I was 16 at the time. The teacher took the manuscript, said, I'm going to give you an A in the course, but I'm not capable of judging this. You need to send it to a professional. At that time, I'm a kid from the projects, didn't know any professionals, certainly no professional writers. She said, well, I'm taking a class with Gwendolyn Brooks. Why don't you send it to her? And what I found after a few months when Gwendolyn Brooks called me with it was that she was this angel, really, who made it her business to nurture young talent. And she invited me into her writers group, and she showed me that it was quite possible for a kid from the projects to believe of becoming a writer on a substantial scale.
Wow. Judge Toler, you have had also many different triumphs and challenges. Becoming a judge, triumph. Leading a successful television show, triumph. But you've also had triumphs that were more personal. Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges you faced growing up and how you overcame those.
Well, I would first like to say that some of those triumphs and the expectations that I have attained are a result of people who had already overachieved a bit. My mother, not unlike Ellis, was born in the south side of Chicago, very poor. My father was born in West Virginia, backwoods Bromwell poverty. Both of them were able to get beyond that, and he became a lawyer and she became a housewife. That was my initial triumph that occurred even before I was born. The difficulty was that my father was both psychotic and an alcoholic, which made growing up in that household extremely difficult. I had my own emotional issues beginning at the age of 9 when I had my first nervous breakdown. I went from there in almost agoraphobic nature to become someone on television, so it was a triumph over, for me personally, emotional difficulties, family dysfunction, and then on a political level, which was the last triumph that I think that I gained, was I was a 33-year-old mother of an 8-month-old running for election in a district where my opposing party outnumbered us 5-1, and no one thought I had an opportunity whatsoever to win, and I pulled off a 6-vote victory. So.
And that's how you
became
a judge.
I've had opportunity on many levels. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, Judge Toler, a lot of people who are in the sciences talk about resilience in this very specific way, having to do with the ability not just to overcome, but to keep overcoming. What does resilience say to you about how people achieve, including people like yourself, who may get punched down and knocked down and knocked down, but still stand up?
My mother's favorite phrase is, keep coming. My mother was a woman who knew how to grind things out. She didn't have extraordinary talent. She didn't have an extraordinary intellect. She says this of herself, so I'm not speaking ill of her. But she has the ability to keep coming. And she taught me that despite whatever fears I might have, which was my great challenge, is that you get up the next day and you keep coming. And eventually, either opportunity will arise or you create one of your own just sheer effort.
Ellis, your series Against the Odds, by its very title, implies that people that you're going to talk to have the deck stacked against them.
Right.
What is it that you were really looking for when you set out to put together this series?
Well, first of all, I mean, I don't believe in the great man theory of history, that great people are born and then achieve greatness because they are destined to do that. I think things happen to people. So what I was looking at was opportunity, how it's created, how people take advantage of it, how people make it for themselves. And the pilot, which is being, as you mentioned, released now and is being aired in most stations across the country, it looks at a young fellow named Abbas Hassan Mohammed who fled Somalia when the war broke out in the early 90s, ended up in this wretched refugee camp in eastern Kenya where they didn't even have schools. They originally were taught by people drawing in the sand, made it from there to Princeton University. And his story, I think, illustrates a lot of what we're trying to do, which is to look at people often from marginalized communities who have managed to accomplish extraordinary things.
Ellis, we actually have some clips from that piece. And here he and his family are in a camp in Kenya, and good fortune shines down.
The constant prodding worked. When Abbas and his younger brother took the test for the Kenya Certificate of Primary Education, they scored first and second highest of all those in Dadaab.
I got 502 points out of 700. My brother scored 508. I mean, that was not extraordinary compared to other parts of Kenya. Like, a kid is scoring 650, 640. But for a kid in a refugee camp who had to learn initially using Somali and then switched to English, that was extremely well.
Abbas's extremely good work was bolstered by extremely good luck. Just in time for him to attend high school, officials built one in the camp. His high test score assured him of a seat.
So he got a seat in high school, and what unfolded from there that got him to Princeton?
Well, first of all, let me just say that his getting a seat in high school was key because there are over at that time, at the time he was there, there were over 200,000 young people in the camp. The high school had seats for about 30 people, 40 people. And if he did not go to high school, he would never have taken the exam. He managed to take this exam, and I have to say his father was a huge influence in his life. His father, who was not very well educated, just imbued in him this passion for education. But once he got into the high school, he studied. He even begged the people in care, which ran the camp, for a rechargeable lamp, which he turned on every night. The first time he turned it on, there's no electricity in the camp. The first time he turned it on, people gathered around to see what in the world was going on there. And this young man just studied his head out. And by the time that he was ready that he took the exam, he was prepared for it. And then next thing he learned was that there was a person in the camp from Princeton who was looking for people who might be able to make it in America, told him that he had to take something called the SAT, which he had never heard of. He managed to get to Nairobi, flew on an airplane for the first time in his life, and took this strange test and did well enough on it so that he's now in Princeton.
Now, Judge Toler, when you listen to that kind of a story, there are a lot of things that people go through in the United States that are absolutely horrific. But there's a certain way in which we have assumptions about how American life can unfold. How does it strike you as somewhat different when you think about someone who has been a political refugee, who's lived in a camp, who's been exposed to the possibility of death? Or is it all the same struggle that we're in?
To some extent, it is all the same struggle, but I think here in America, we have such a sense of relative deprivation when we're in a circumstance where we see so much and don't have so much. And I used to train at-risk girls, and I used to talk to them every week. And it sort of seemed to a lot of them that they didn't understand the necessity of effort. They say, I don't have this. Here are my obstacles. Hence, I will not continue to strive. And what I used to tell them was that sometimes the difference between leading an ordinary and extraordinary life is simply a matter of effort. Not all the time, but some of the time. And if you do make that effort, things will change. And I think that here in America, there is so much opportunity that we gloss over and we don't really see it and understand it until we hear a story like that and think, given his odds, what am I not doing here when my odds are much less against me?
Ellis, it sounds like Judge Toler is almost saying that living in the land of plenty can make you feel like you have less just because we have so much here. Do you find that that's something that...
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think there's a sense in which success is also relative. And if you are in, say, the kind of community I grew up in or some other so-called ghettos across America, you just sort of often have a sense that you just can't get to where other people are. But I think there's also something very common. I mean, we are in a global economy now. Even if you don't have electricity and don't have televisions, you're aware that there's a world out there of wealth and riches and opportunity. And for me, there are just some keys to some of these people that we will be profiling and that have allowed them to overcome what they overcame. And one is passion, which is very similar to what Judge Toler is talking about, just the passion to keep going, to keep moving, to feel passionate about something. But there are also a couple of other things that I would say are equally important. I mean, one is having some help, a patron, a guide, someone who recognizes that you have some ability and takes an interest in you. I don't think anyone I've profiled or that I've talked to has been able to make it without that element as well. And then, of course, there's the element of being prepared. You have to have some kind of preparation to take advantage of these opportunities.
Well, we are going to stay with you guys. We're going to keep this conversation going after a short break, so stick with us. I have been talking to Ellis Coase of Newsweek, and he's got a public radio international show, Against the Odds, also speaking with Judge Lynn Toler of TV's Divorce Court. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are back and ready to talk more about overcoming odds, big and small, with Judge Lynn Toler of TV's Divorce Court and journalist Ellis Coase of Newsweek, and now the program Against the Odds with Public Radio International. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Judge Toler, it sounds like you have a lot of experience in working with young women. You have a lot of experience in working with young people, period. How do you target a message of triumphing over the odds to younger people who may not have had as much life experience?
I think the first thing I do is talk to the errors, the common errors that I saw. The reason that I went to the high schools in the first place, actually went back to the junior highs, was once they were already in the courtroom with me, it was too late. Not too late, but very, very difficult. Three children, no high school diploma, and I wanted to get to them before the major mistakes were made. So what I needed to do, and what they do need, is a stable figure that will allow them to do the right thing on a daily basis, or simply not do the wrong thing on a daily basis when they're getting all the wrong messages from the entire community around them about what to do. So it was more of a stabilizing factor in the beginning to help them avoid the difficult things or the wrong things, which are so easy and so much more fun to do.
What really reached a tough case? Someone who didn't want to listen to what you were saying but ultimately got it.
What reached a tough case? Consistency. I kept coming. I didn't show up every once in a while. I kept coming. I'd go over to their house. I would take them out. I kept coming, and I didn't have to. And that made them think, I am of value. I am worthwhile, which I found was a great problem, a self-esteem, especially with young African-American women in the socioeconomic class that I was dealing with.
Ellis, in your doc, Against the Odds, we're talking again about Abbas Hassan Muhammad, who really started out in this refugee situation. And you mentioned his father. Here's another clip from the documentary. The first voice we hear is of him and then his father.
What people normally do is they'll tie that umbilical cord with what they want their child to be passionate of in the future. If they want their child to like keeping animals, then they'll tie that onto an animal.
I decided that when a child is born in my family, instead of tying the umbilical cord to an animal, I tie it to a book, and then I would bury it near a school. A book and a pen. I did that for all of my children.
That ritual was just the beginning. Day after day, in talking to his children, Hassan Muhammad drove home the point, above all else, excel in school. The constant prodding worked. When Abbas and his younger brother took the test for the Kenya Certificate of Primary Education, they scored first and second highest.
So when you think, Ellis, about the taking this very traditional symbolic action of what you want for a child and applying it to the age of learning, what does that say to you about that father and his belief and his expectations for his children?
The father is an incredible man. I mean, I spent lots of time with him in the refugee camp in Kenya, and he is just a very powerful personality, a very strong figure. But part of his own background was that he came from a tribe, a clan, a caste in Somalia that is looked down upon by the majority clan. And what he discovered is the only thing that allowed him to get ahead, and in his life getting ahead meant getting a small-time job as a government clerk, was to leave his village, go someplace where no one knew him, knew what tribe he was from, and get some education, because he would not have been allowed to get education where he came from. And that was the key lesson in his life for him, that education could allow you to get to a place where otherwise you could not get. And he beat this message literally into his children. He says at one point, you know, during our interview, that he caned his son to stop him from playing sports to drive home the point that he needed to get an education. Now that's extreme, but he clearly put the idea in his children's heads that education was something they just had to become passionate about, and they did become passionate about it.
Judge Toler, I have to bring this up. We've had a lot of stories recently where people talk about physical discipline of kids. Is that the path that you have to go? It's a raging debate, and I want to at least share it with the listeners. What's your point of view?
I don't think anything is a have to. I mean, there are always different circumstances, and you have to deal with the child, their circumstances, and the issue. I personally got spanked. My kids did. Rare but memorable. You know, but the concern people have with spanking, and I will agree with this, is that most often when you do, when parents do spank, you find that they do so out of anger, and that is more assaultive than educational. And that is why I think that the decision to spank is such a huge one, because it's normally not done correctly because we don't have the emotional control to employ it correctly.
Well, Judge, we're about to wrap this up. That was a little digression into an important topic. If you had to sum up, no, I asked it, and it is important. It's been coming up a lot. But if you had to say one thing about how to reach people who may have given up in their lives, what would it be? Or to reach your heart if you've given up?
Listen. And find out what it is that will make them passionate, will make them care. And I think that's very much exemplified by the story that we've been told. You listen and you find out what they're missing and what they want, and you appeal to those things.
Ellis, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I obviously agree with that. And I think that the key to the people that we've talked to has been that they have found themselves in a place where even if most people don't believe they can do something, and all the people we've talked to have faced that, they at least believe that they can. And that belief converts other people ultimately into believers as well.
Well, Ellis, Judge Toler, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Ellis Coase of Newsweek and the Public Radio International show Against the Odds joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. And Judge Lynn Toler presides over television's divorce court. She joined us from Great Scott Productions in Phoenix, Arizona. It's time now for a look at sports. And for that, we turn to NPR's Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
So what you got?
Well, football. And did I say football? It's been an interesting week of college bowl matchups so far. The pros are about to start their playoffs this weekend, and we'll be checking in on the progress of the black quarterback with the man who wrote the book on that subject, New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill.
The great Tony Cox. Happy New Year, man.
Happy New Year to you as well. Although, you know what? It's not such a happy New Year for the bowl championship series, I don't think. We've had three or four games so far, and I don't know. It looks like the lineups just didn't quite work out the way people wanted them to. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, number one, the fraud continues. I mean, this bowl stuff without a playoff is one of the greatest hoaxes in the history of college sports. You know, Tony, Hawaii's loss to Georgia is 41-10. Did more to set back the cause of the underdog than anything that's happened the last 10 years. Last year, remember, we were talking about Boise State, and, okay, let's bring in the underdogs, and then these guys come out here undefeated and get trampled. Then you look at West Virginia killing Oklahoma, 48-28. Then you look at Illinois getting routed by USC, and I think when you have a playoff, you've got the sort of competitive tension where the games continue to get better and tighter as you go on a competition. Tony, this is really, really just too much. And the president at the NCAA convention in a couple of weeks, they've got to do something about this. This year, I think, underlines the fact that you have to have a playoff, and the fact that the presidents continue to perpetrate this fraud on the American people is unconscionable.
Do you think that the title game between Ohio State and LSU is going to save things this year for BCS?
Well, I think it's going to be a much better game. It's going to be a much more competitive game. But what's going to save it? No, I think the taste has already been, the sour taste has already been lost and left in everybody's mouth.
All right, let's move on to the people that play on Sundays, every Sunday.
That's right, real football.
Wild card weekend coming up this weekend. Anything that's surprising to you about who's there and who's not there?
Well, you know, I mean, Washington clearly, I think, is the, to the extent that the NFL could have a sentimental favorite, I think that Washington is a sentimental favorite. You know, with everything that's happened, I think Washington is a surprise. I do not think that they're going to beat Seattle. Seattle is a very difficult place to play, and Seattle quietly is just gotten very good. They're a very good team. I think the surprise of the whole thing, Tony, sorry, I think the surprise of the whole thing, though, is going to be New York.
I was going to ask, as a matter of fact, do you think that there is any team in the wild card round that was a wild card team capable of going all the way?
you know, I do like New York, and I know it's not just because I live in New York.
Yes, it is.
Okay. I just think that they've just got a nice package. You know, we beat up Eli Manning here, but Eli Manning, Tony, has won as many playoff games as your guy in Dallas, Tony Romo.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Giants have a nice team.
Well, last topic, because our sports segment is a little shorter this week than it normally is. You wrote a book called Trials and Tribulations of the Black Quarterback. Looking at this season and the number of black quarterbacks that are out there, some of whom, like Michael Vick, made headlines for the wrong reasons, are they still in a trial and tribulation situation like Donovan McNabb of Philadelphia referred to earlier this season?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. So I think it's definitely in the trial. There's always a trial. I think there's still this kind of burden of proof, you know. And I'm listening. I listen to the commentators all the time. There's always a little undercurrent where they're talking about Vince Young. You know, there's always something he's got to learn. I mean, you know, everybody's got to learn something. But I think with black quarterbacks, there's still this kind of burden of proof that they still have to kind of prove that they can be the ultimate winners.
Doesn't everybody have to do that? And aren't there so many, maybe so many is not the right word, but aren't there enough black quarterbacks in the NFL now where that's not the issue that it once was?
Well, you think so, but I think that's exactly what Donovan was saying at the beginning of the year, that yes, there are more, but there's always this double standard. There's always, you got to do just a little bit more. And when you fail, it's, well, are his mechanics, or does he have a grasp of the game? You know, and if you listen very closely to criticism, you'll hear it. So, no, I think we still have ways to go.
Who's the best black quarterback in the NFL?
The best black quarterback in the NFL. Well, you know what?
Who?
David Garrard of Jacksonville. David Garrard of Jacksonville is the real deal. He's got the goods. Watch him.
All right, let's flip the script then. So who's the worst black quarterback in the NFL? Come on, you're a sports columnist for a big-time paper.
Well,
the worst one.
Okay, well, in terms of judgment, Michael Vick. Worst judgment of all time.
Who's the worst on the field?
On the field, probably Brian Leftwich. Brian Leftwich, who at one time was kind of considered the best, has had a very, very, very dramatic fall. So I'd have to say Brian Leftwich was probably the worst on the field.
I'm sure he'll be text messaging you later in the day. Bill, as always, it's good talking to you.
Same to you, Tony. You take care.
Okay.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with Bill Roden. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. It's Thursday, the day we read from your letters. Here with me now to sort through all the mail is producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Hey, Farai, how you doing?
Doing great. What are folks writing about?
Well, on Christmas Day last week, Farai, you spoke with gospel singer Kirk Franklin. He opened up about some rough times he's been going through with his family, but you also had some light moments, like this one, with Franklin joking about how to discipline kids when they act like they have lost their minds.
I don't have a problem popping with my little ones on their behind when they try to get too, you know, crazy. And because there are a lot of kids I see in grocery stores, and it's like, man, please, can I pop your child? Please. Here's my number. And if you need somebody to whoop your kids, you can page me 24 hours. Because I thought about starting a little side job and give me some cars and say, I'll whoopyourkids.com.
Kirk may have thought that was funny, but listener Madeline Marr of Ithaca, New York, was so not amused. Madeline writes, for Kirk Franklin, who was abandoned by his parents and raised by relatives who, according to him, raised him in this manner, to be propagating the same kind of misunderstanding and anger only shows me that he is still under the thumb of that abuse and very much in denial. But you as a journalist, your inability to be a critical voice in that conversation was beyond disappointing. Did I hear you actually giggle?
We also got a letter about our tribute to Canadian jazz pianist Oscar Peterson. Peterson died last week at the age of 82, and Barry Solan in Newark, Delaware, felt we didn't give Mr. Peterson his due. Barry writes, when speaking of the latter years of Oscar's life and career, you wrote it off by saying merely, after his stroke in 1993, Oscar slowed down. The piece reduces this period of Oscar's life to being some sort of post-career epilogue. It ignored both the great recordings that were produced during this period and the inspiring approach that Oscar took in his response to this unexpected malady. Oscar chose to struggle and rethink his approach to the piano, as opposed to resting on his laurels, as the News and Notes piece implies.
But it's not all bad news from the mailbag. Elias Zagara in Santa Rosa, California, sent us a little love. I want to thank you for a great program, he writes. The fairness of the way you treat your subjects makes your program the best in my list. I'm not African American, but I feel I don't have to be in order to listen to your program. The way you shine a light on subjects no other program deals with makes me feel welcome, actually at home. The very best for Ms. Chidea and all the folks that work on this program.
Hey, Elias, thanks so much. We really appreciate the big up here. Make sure you stay tuned. We have some great radio coming up in the new year, particularly on the Political Tip.
But for now, that's it for letters. Please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Christopher, thanks.
Happy New Year, Farah.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, post-Iowa politics and our Reporters Roundtable.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.